This is Invest Talk, above average investing for the average investor. Invest Talk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, here's KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Money Manager Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Invest Talk. This is our Tuesday, December 9th, 2014 edition of Invest Talk. And the main topic of our show is a four-step checklist to evaluate any mutual fund. This is important for all those out there that might have a 401k or just looking to build a portfolio that's, you know, diversified. So welcome to our Tuesday edition of Invest Talk, and we're here heard on radio in California, streaming live 4 to 5 Pacific time, wherever and whenever you want, by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes and all the other podcast outlets that are out there in the world today, in the tech world today. So download our Anywhere app right there on investtalk.com. Well, it's not our app, but it's a popular app. It's called TuneIn Radio. Free for anybody to go download, and it's a great app to download to your tablet or your smartphone, and allows you to listen to our show and many other types of podcasts whenever you want. So we'd love to talk about money with you today, and our emphasis is on investing it wisely. But before you invest it, you have to manage it. And from the time you cash your paycheck to when you draw funds out of your retirement account, every step along the way, we all make decisions that make a difference. So we're here for you, and please check in with any of your money-related questions. We want to hear about it. What are you thinking? You know, we always like questions that broaden out the topic of investing. You know, not just one particular investment, and that's fine. If you want to know about a particular stock, that's fine too. But you know, we try to broaden it out so that everybody can really gain some knowledge while we're answering people's questions. All right, so you know, we're here for you, so please check in with your questions. What are the realities of today's economic marketplace? What are the geopolitical risks that could give us reason to adjust our investment strategy? Now, yesterday, Steve wrote about the dropping oil prices in his market commentary. He said, it's easy to see the benefits of lower oil prices in the U.S. The consumer, in effect, will have a tax reduction. And the estimate for 2015 is about $1,700 per person based on gasoline and home heating oil spending. Now, since two-thirds of our economy is the consumer, that money will benefit the economy. But he said, there's another side of the story. Taking a broader view, lower oil prices helps countries that consume it, and higher oil prices help countries that produce it. And those countries that produce it rely on oil to run their countries and have gotten very rich and dependent on high oil prices. So lower oil revenue can have a disturbing effect on matters that can impact the stability of volatile regions like Venezuela and Russia. So as oil prices drop, how do you respond as an investor? Do you panic out? Since names have dropped, I mean, I got an email last night or today, and this woman had four stocks, and they were all oil-related stocks. Now, I don't know what percentage of her portfolio that was, but I could imagine this might have been too big of a percentage of her portfolio, and she was kind of freaking out. And you know, this is an example of why you need to always have your eye on risk and understanding the diversity in your portfolio, and you know, understand the markets that you're investing in and sectors you're investing in. So as oil drops, how do you respond as an investor? So let's talk about it, or bring up your own topic, whatever it is. We can talk about housing, interest rates, currencies, the global economy, specific countries throughout the world. Remember, we focus on a lot of things. It's not just about here in America. It's not just one industry. It's not just one asset class. You know, our job is to understand them all at any given time. And that's what we do every day. And that's what you need to do every day if you want to be ahead of the game. So let's check in with our 24-hour listener line. This one came in after our last program at 888-99-CHART.
This is Steve from Port Huron, Michigan. I listen to you on podcasts. I want to thank you so much for your show. I've learned a lot. I have a question. I have about 60% of my retirement in Vanguard bond funds, and I've been listening to you, and I know I should have got out before now, but I was wondering if I should wait for an upturn before I sell or if I should just get out today. I'll be listening to your show. Thank you very much.
Well, he's in Vanguard bond funds. You know, it shouldn't be a terrible place to be right now unless you're in junk bonds, which that's possible. Because if you look at the aggregate bond fund, which is the which AGG is the symbol, iShares Core U.S. Aggregate Bond Fund, so it kind of encompasses treasuries, encompasses mortgage securities, junk bonds as well, treasury inflation protected securities. So it's kind of a broad basket, you know, talking about high-grade corporate bonds, municipal bonds. So it really is a broad scope of the bond sector, and, you know, it's not doing bad. So I'm not sure why you're too worried about it. A lot of it, you know, depends on your age. A lot of it depends on your goals. You know, you sounded pretty young, so I think 60% might be a little high. But then again, you might be risk averse, and you might not, you know, might not be a person that wants to take or willing to take a lot of risk. You may not need to take a lot of risk because you might save a lot of money, have a ton of money saved for retirement, and your goals are modest, and you're okay. So, you know, a lot of it depends. It's hard for me to say exactly. I don't know what Vanguard bond funds you're in. So what I would say is go to our website. Take the free risk analysis questionnaire and, you know, put in your number at the end. We can call you, help you out with that, and hopefully guide you in the right path. So, you know, question is kind of broad, so there's a lot of variables that make it difficult to give you a straight answer. So hopefully you can give us a little more information. Now, there's a whole list of mutual funds offered in your 401k plan. Which one should you trust with your retirement savings? A four-step checklist to evaluate any mutual fund and whether it's right for you. That's one of our talking points today, but I also want to touch on a few more things. There's a couple that I didn't get to at the in the show yesterday, but so we're going to try to get to those. One is the 3% down mortgages are on the comeback with Fannie and Freddie. I touched on it right at the end of yesterday's show, but I want to talk about it a little further because it's kind of interesting and kind of scary at the same time. I also want to touch on, what is the ideal budget? Do you budget for yourself? Do you create a budget? How much should you spend a month on housing and transportation and clothing, entertainment, you know, food and dining out? Do you know? I'm going to give you a breakdown. Pretty simple. Should be easy for most people, but I'll give you how much the average American spends on housing, transportation, and groceries and dining, and then talk a little bit about, you know, those other areas that you need to fill into the budget. And I think it's important to really give you a sense of whether you're overspending in one area or maybe you're okay with taking from one area of your budget and moving it to another. It's probably a smart idea. So we're going to talk about the ideal budget, and I think that kind of goes in line with that 3% mortgage news that came out yesterday. I also want to talk a little bit about Jeffrey Gundlach. He had a double line. He's one of the best bond fund managers in the world. He's the CEO of Double Line Capital or Double Line Funds, and he's a pretty smart guy. He actually predicted just about a month and a half ago, that oil would go to $70, and he's been right. It's been below 70. So I want to touch on what he said, and I think that's it's interesting because he touches on very broad scopes, so the global economy, interest rates, the Fed, commodities. It's very, very interesting. And then I also want to touch on one thing I didn't get to yesterday was looking back at the tech boom and bust, what were some successful IPOs, some not so successful IPOs then and now? What have gone public recently that were a success and what have flopped? And then what are on the private market right now? What companies are there? Companies like Airbnb, Dropbox, Pinterest, Square. How much are they worth? And which ones have the best chance to be great long-term investments, even though they're probably expensive today? So I want to touch on that. And then if we get to it, I have four things investors do in December, the end of the year. There's a lot to talk about. But ultimately, I want to hear from you. 888-99-CHART is our number, 888-992-4278. Now, you come first, and we want to hear your questions. Give us a call. 888-99-CHART is how to reach us right now with your money topics on Invest Talk. Let's go to Neaton in Fremont. How you doing, Neaton?
Hey, Justin. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for making it.
I had a question regarding the diversification of your portfolio when it comes to oil and gold. I'm new to diversification and investments in general, and this year I tried to diversify my portfolio outside of what I had available in my 401k, and I ended up taking 18% position in oil and gold, and that has not been doing well at all this year. Mm-hmm. What would you recommend? Would you recommend just keep trying to add and keep that 10% or be more aggressive and try to recover some of the losses I've made, that I have a long time horizon?
Did you say 10%?
10% of my portfolio divided equally between oil and gold.
Yeah, I don't think that's crazy. I don't think that's out of whack. I don't think that's too high. It depends on, your long-term outlook for those sectors. I would have probably a stronger outlook on the gold market in the near term, because there's tight supply in the gold market, and the sentiment is really bad it's been bad for 3 years, where oil just started to get bad, and I don't think the sentiment has bottomed out yet. Now, could it bounce in the short term? I think it probably will. But I think you're looking at prices of oil staying down in the $60 to $80 area for an extended period of time. I think it all depends on your time horizon. But if you're looking, thinking those are out of whack, I don't think those are out of whack. And just because it hasn't worked that great this year doesn't mean it's not going to work great next year. So I wouldn't get too discouraged by a very short term view of what prices have done.
Right. So I guess the question is: Is the percentage that I'm trying to maintain reasonable? And
yes, I would say. I would say it's reasonable. I think 10% is just fine.
All right.
Thanks, Nate.
Thank you very much.
No problem. The Wall Street Journal reports that fracking oil, along with oil from tar sands in Canada and deep offshore oil, becomes unprofitable if prices drop below $60 and $65 and stay there. Let's talk about it. Give us a call, 888-99-CHART.
Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. Here's an amazing factoid. 54% of plan sponsors report that their 401k participants aren't taking full advantage of their plan's investment options or features and services. Communication is the key, and it can be an added challenge for employers, too. Find out more about the 401k solution. Just go to investtalk.com and click on Contact Justin and write 401k. No one will call you, but you will receive a packet of information by email.
888-99-CHART. Give us a call. Try to get your call in sooner rather than later. Don't try to squeeze in the last 5 minutes, or at least I hope you don't. Let's take a quick look at the market today. The Dow closed down 51 points. The S&P closed basically flat, down 2 cents, 2 hundredths of 1%, really did nothing. The NASDAQ was up 25 points. The big mover was actually the Russell 2000. Small caps were surprisingly strong. I didn't really get that, but they were strong. The junk bond market sold off again, but it kind of rallied most of the day. So it was kind of early in the session, there was a lot of stocks down, and throughout the day the market kind of rallied and got back to that flat level. And I think you're probably get used to this for the month of December. And I think there's going to be a lot of volatility, and I say that, I mean upside and downside. We're seeing a market where volatility is rising, but you know the indexes aren't really going anywhere. They're just kind of chopping sideways, and I expect a little bit more of that. You had Greece down. Greece was down big. They brought their elections. They called for their elections to, I think, a little bit sooner. They're holding their presidential elections next week, and there are no candidates yet. So there's a lot of uncertainty going on with Greece. I don't know if you understand the politics that are happening in Greece, but there's not just two parties in Greece. There's multiple parties. There's a lot of issues, obviously, because of their budget and certain parties that have a good following and certainly have the ability to win a presidential election, considering how fragmented their political system is right now. There's certain parties that would just rather default on the debt and not sit here and deal with all these bailouts and strap their country with austerity for as many years as they have. And so that kind of I think smacked the market in a lot of ways. And China was also down. China was also down overnight. There's been a surge in the Shanghai index and the A shares because it's kind of opening up to the global marketplace and becoming easier to buy shares there. But it's a lot of people that are buying shares are buying it on leverage, so there's going to be a lot of volatility there. So there's a lot going on in the global marketplace. You know, with oil prices low, what are the final ramifications with Venezuela? Because Venezuela will likely default on its debt at some point. And, this drop in oil prices is only getting it closer and closer to that nadir. So, a lot going on with the global marketplace in the commodities market and the foreign currency market and the bond market. But really kind of at the end of the day, the S&P was flat. So, kind of an odd day, a lot of volume, and you should expect a lot of chop for the rest of the year. Now let's take a quick look at our talking points today, real quick. It's about the top four things that you should look at when you're evaluating a mutual fund. What's the checklist? Well, the first check you should mark is, does this fit into your broad strategy? You have to have an investment plan. You have to figure out, what is my asset allocation going to be? And I'm talking about if this is your 401k or your IRA or whatever it is, you have to have some sort of plan. And why? Why is that your plan? Is it because you have a certain view on risk? You have a certain risk tolerance that you want to have? You like certain asset classes because of certain valuations or growth reasons, whatever it is. But you have to have an investment plan before you select the funds that you're looking at. Then you go, okay, I want to buy a foreign mutual fund, foreign equity fund, right? For example. Then you can say, okay, I just want to look at those. What are those? Which one are those available? Then you want to cut out any transaction costs that you might have to pay. You want to look at funds with below average expense ratio. You know, they don't have to be super low, but I think fund with below average expense ratio is important. And then, what is their management style? Do you know, are they growth? Are they value? What is their longer-term track record compared to their peers? That's very important. And then number four, the last one is taxes. You know, how is this going to affect you from a tax perspective? If it's an IRA or a 401k, you don't really care. about the tax implications. That means bond funds, REITs, things that throw up big dividends, regular dividends, they're good to have inside 401ks and IRAs, not mass limited partnerships because that's kind of an issue. But those are good. And then anything high risk is usually pretty good because, you know, if there's big gains, hopefully you get it at the right time and you're doing the right thing. High risk doesn't always mean a bad investment. You know, then you can take those big, large gains and not pay taxes on them. So that's our main talking point today, and that's what you have to think about when you're evaluating mutual funds that you have available to you in whatever account you're at. Now, why are we spending more and more on our cell phones? InvestTalk Personal is coming up in the next half hour on InvestTalk. I'm portfolio manager Justin Klein, and I'm here to answer your money questions now at 888-99-CHART. Now, just because you listen to our podcast in the middle of the night doesn't mean you can't ask your question when it pops into your head. You can call it anytime. It's our anytime line at 888-99-CHART, and we'll answer this question. We'll answer your question the next day, and here's a question that came in overnight.
Hello, my name is Dave. I'm from Livermore. I'm calling about information on a stock symbol is IRDU, Iridium Company, who does work with satellites. Can you give me a rundown on that stock, whether or not it's a good investment or not? Thank you.
All right, he's looking at Iridium Communications. The X symbol is IRDM. I think he said IRDU, but it's IRDM. And they do provide mobile voice and data communication services via satellites to areas poorly served by terrestrial networks. So kind of off the beaten path, small company, 873 million shares, or sorry, $837 million market cap. So definitely in the small cap space. No dividend, a good amount of debt, 111% debt to equity ratio, but their cash flows are pretty steady, which is good. They do have negative cash flow. They're on a negative cash flow rate, but that's something that is not that crazy considering the industry that's so consistent, but I do like to see companies that have positive cash flow, so I like that. But it's getting better. They had negative $200 million in cash flow last year, and now they're down to $100 million negative, so that's definitely improving. Not very profitable, though. Return on equity only 5%. That's down from about 8% in 2012. Earnings supposed to bounce back next year to go up 16% after falling 37% this year. And sales are starting to climb again. They were falling most of 2013, and now all three quarters this year they've been going up at a high single-digit rate, about 8% on average. So things are starting to turn around, and the chart looks like it's in a strong upward trend. I like that. There's definitely some strength to the chart. So I don't hate it. It's not expensive. A 9 PE ratio based on next year's earnings, it's probably closer to 12 or 13, but that's not too expensive. Trading below book value, 0.91 times book value. So on a book value basis, it's pretty cheap. And they've been paying down their debt, which is good. I don't hate it. I actually kind of like it. It's definitely a higher risk because it's a small cap name, but it's also lower risk than the average small cap because it's in telecom. And I don't think all those people that are in those rural areas are probably going to move. There's not going to be a big exodus out of rural areas, I think, into more populated areas. I think those people that live out there like it out there. And I don't see that the traditional carriers like Verizon, AT&T, I don't think they're going to spend the money to go serve that very niche market. It's too expensive for them. So I kind of like this name, and I think it has some good upside potential and isn't too expensive. That was Iridium Communications. IRDM is the symbol. Now let's talk a little bit about your budget. And I want to connect this down back to the 3% down payment mortgage that was announced, a program that was announced by Fannie and Freddie yesterday. And it says they're going to start backing mortgages with down payments of as little as 3% of the home price. Now, I am a firm believer, and this goes back to the boom days, back in 2004, 2005, when we on the air were saying, people call us up and said, should I take a couple hundred thousand dollars out of my home to buy more property, and you know, got super aggressive in the real estate space. And we said, no, you want to pay down your mortgage, you want to be conservative. But a lot of people hated us at that time, thought we were idiots, but you know, time obviously told the true story. Now we're back to doing the same thing. Fannie and Freddie are giving 3% mortgages. Now, obviously, it's probably not as reckless as it was, and they're verifying incomes now. You do have to buy private mortgage insurance. The agencies are requiring borrowers to receive home ownership counseling, and they're going to start backing these loans as soon as the 13th of this month. Fannie will and Freddie will start offering on March 23rd. Now, they already back mortgages as low as 5% down, and the FHA insures some mortgages at 3.5%, but this is going to make that 3% requirement kind of broaden it out. And I just think this is a bad idea. It's idiotic. The housing market should be 20% down. 20% down. If a housing market can't handle the need for buyers to use 20% down, then the market is too overvalued. It needs to come down to a reasonable level. Now, what they're trying to do here is broaden this out, get more mortgages to younger people who are having trouble getting that 20% down because they have a lot of student debt and they just can't get to that point. So I think it's dumb that they're doing this. They should stick to 20% down and keep it that way. But this brings me back to your overall budget. And I want to touch on this because I think a lot of people don't sit down, they don't plan on a budget, they don't think about what they need to do with the money that's coming in and what percentage needs to be allocated to certain areas. And what we say is housing should be 30% of your budget. Now, a lot of banks will lend if you're on a mortgage that's 51%, up to 51% of your income. Now, just because the bank is going to let you do it doesn't mean you should do it. You should do 20% down, 30% of your income. That's what should be going to housing. Housing related. That means your mortgage plus taxes plus insurance plus, you know, everything that's related to keeping and owning that home. Okay? And this applies to renters as well. So if you're renting, it should be more than 30% of your income. Then transportation, that should be 15% of your income. That includes car payment, gasoline, you know, the insurance on your car, 15% transportation. Groceries and dining, 12% of your budget. Savings, yes, savings should be part of your budget. That's 10%. You're saving 10%. Okay? Utilities and phone, that's 10% as well. Utilities, cell phone, 10% of your budget. Clothing, 5% of your budget. Entertainment, 5% of your budget. Medical expenses, 5% of your budget. Holidays, gifts, 5% of your budget. And then miscellaneous, 3%, you know, that could go to, you know, a hobby of yours or whatever you think is appropriate. Now, the average American spends $1,400, call it $8 on housing per month. The average American spends $638 a month on transportation. And the average American spends $531 a month on groceries and dining. It's according to the U.S. Department of Labor in 2010. So it's a little older, but gives you kind of a good idea to see where you're at, where the rest of the country's at. And I think, you know, hopefully you wrote those numbers down. If not, you can always go to our website and listen to the archive show. Go subscribe on iTunes, listen to it back again, and write those down and see where you're at. You know, you're not going to be 100% accurate on each one, but you need to be roughly in those zones and to get to that 100% pie that is your total income. Now, if you follow us on Twitter, you can get your question or comments to us by sending us a message. Our address is at KPP Financial. It's our handle, at KPP Financial. Or you can reach us anytime by phone at 888-99-CHART. Let's talk about it.
Why not sign up to be an InvestTalk Insider? Don't miss out on access to helpful investment watch lists and chart lessons. You get instant access to a library of webinars, updates providing valuable market guidance, too. Sign up when you're ready. It's free on investtalk.com.
Hi, my name is Rich. I'm from Columbia, South Carolina, and I'm a podcast listener. And first, I want to thank you for your program. It's incredibly helpful and insightful, especially as a new investor. The reason for my call is I'm wondering how you go about determining value for a stock quickly and reliably and accurately. I know it's kind of a good idea to always know how to do it by hand, sort of like remembering how to do long division as a student, even though we have calculators. But I'm wondering if when you're pouring through these, you know, hundreds of stocks, you know, if there's a quicker way to do it, you know, semi-automatically or even automatically in a way that's reliable and quick and easy. So I hope to hear you on the air, and thank you for all you do. Thanks. Bye.
That is, he basically asked, what is the holy grail of investing? He might as well have asked that, because that's how difficult that question is. Quickly, accurately, and reliably. Valuation is never quick. It's somewhat reliable. What was the third one? Quickly and accurate. Yeah, I mean, reliable and accurate, it's kind of the same thing. You know, there's always different types of metrics that you can use. There's metrics based on the dividend rate, how consistent that dividend is. What we like to do, and I think one of my favorite things to do when I'm looking at the statistics of a particular company and the valuation, I like to look. I love cash flow. I think cash flow is the number one thing I go to. Is it creating operating cash flow? And then is that coming down into free cash flow? And I love free cash flow because that is money that goes to the balance sheet of the company. And the company can either pay it out as a dividend, they can buy back stock, they can reinvest in their business. Hopefully they do that, because usually that's the best return over the long term for a particular company. If they are highly profitable, usually they have a, you know, high return on equity, hopefully. So, you know, if a company has good cash flow and high profitability, meaning high return on assets, return on equity, those are great starting metrics that I love to see. And then I say, okay, what is their free cash flow per share? And what is it trading at now? And I try to calculate some sort of a yield. So, for example, it's $1 in free cash flow per share, and it's trading at $10 a share. Well, then that is a 10% free cash flow yield. That is very attractive, especially in an environment where interest rates are very low. Now, if interest rates were 20% and you have a 10% free cash flow yield, it's not that attractive. So in this environment where yields are so low, you know, 6% free cash flow yield, 5% free cash flow yield, that is very attractive. Okay, so that is the first starting point. I see that, okay. Then I look into growth. Is the growth steady? Are they having problems with their business? Do they pay a dividend? What is the book value? Is it trading at a high multiple of book value? So to say there's a quick, easy, accurate, reliable way to find a value of a company? No. There's a quick and dirty, which you could say, okay, what's the growth rate long term? Which that could, you could be wrong. I think growth rate's 15, and it could be 10, it could be 30. But say it's 15. Well, I want it to trade. I want to get double the growth rate. I want the P to be half the growth rate. So growth rate's 20. I want the P to be 10. Growth rate's 50. I want the P ratio to be 25 or less. A lot of it depends on growth. So there's so many variables, and that's why you have to really understand the business as a whole. You have to look at other companies that are out there in the marketplace. All these variables matter, and there's no one quick and easy way. Let's go to Daniel in Menlo Park. How you doing, Daniel?
Hi, doing great. Listening to your show every day. Love it on 1220. Just had a quick question. If I can get away with two stock symbols or just one. The first one is White Wave Foods. WWAV is the symbol, and the other is Gilead Pharmaceuticals that I know you're familiar with.
Yeah, I'll do Gilead quickly. It has great numbers and great growth. The biggest problem with Gilead is that it charges a ton for its drugs, and there's been some scrutiny from Congress on how much they charge, $1,000 a day. And you know, that's great for the company, but I have a feeling in the longer term there's going to be some big scrutiny from Congress on them, and that puts a lot of risk. Could keep going up, but it's very, very high risk because of that reason. It relies a lot on one single drug. So I'll talk just quickly on that. And White Wave Company, this manufacturer markets plant-based foods, beverages, coffee creamers, premium dairy products. So it's kind of in the vegan space, right? And that's there's a lot of people that are going that way, and I like that. I think it's a healthier way of living and eating. It's good growth. I like it. I think it's a good company, pretty profitable, and it's improving, and the chart is looking strong. It's a small cap or kind of mid cap, modest amount of debt, very profitable. I like it. I'd go for it.
Thanks, okay, Daniel. Man. Thanks.
Now we're moving into our last segment of the hour. We've got about 10 minutes left. Let's see if we can get your question in. There's a line open for you to get in now. Give us a call at 888-992-4278.
Thanks for being a podcast subscriber. And even though you listen after our daily production time, you can still be part of the discussion. Your questions and comments set the tone and the topics. So please participate. Just call 888-99-CHART anytime. And if you'd like to talk live to Steve and Justin, just make that call between 4 and 5 p.m. Pacific time.
888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Let's go to Arthur in San Francisco. How are you doing, Arthur?
Okay, thank you. What is your opinion about Arista? Symbol is ANET.
Arista Networks.
Networks, correct.
Yeah, they provide cloud networking software and hardware for internet and cloud service providers and next-gen data centers. So it's a cloud computing name. Recent IPO, an IPO in June. Yeah. And, you know, it's a strong growth, 92% earnings growth this year. But analysts are only expecting 9% earnings growth next year. That's kind of interesting to me. You would think, you know, a high flyer name like this, analysts would expect rapid growth again next year. I would wonder, why is it slowing down so dramatically? Do you know much about Arista Networks?
Somebody was telling me that there's a lawsuit against them.
A lawsuit. That's not good. Yeah, I would be a little worried about that. You know, you're paying a lot for this name. P ratio is 53. And, you know, if they're keeping up that 92% growth rate, okay, I'll pay 53 times earnings.
Yes.
And they have strong cash flow, and that's, you know, and it's rising. It was $14 million in 2013. And it's going to be $77 million trailing 12 months. That's a big increase, and I like that trajectory. But why are analysts expecting it to, you know, decelerate so dramatically next year? And their return equity has gone from 165 in 2012 down to 14, and a lot of that's paying down debt, so I understand that. But still, their return assets and profitability are still kind of going down. They're kind of languishing. I think this is too high risk. You know, with like you said, with the lawsuits and the their earnings slowing down, profitability slowing down. It's in a great space, but you know, anything a recent IPO like this and you know growth is slowing down, that's a big red flag for me.
Thank you very much. Because the other day it went to 88. You can't compare 88 and now it's 55 or 53, is it?
Yeah, it was closed at 66 at the close today. Hit a low of 59 yesterday, and just a few months ago it was at about $95 a share. So it's had a pretty big fall, and you know, it's still looking bearish.
I don't think I should touch it.
Yeah, I wouldn't touch it either, Arthur.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. That was Arista Networks, A R I S T A. The symbol is ANET, A N E T. And that brings me quickly, before we close the show, to going back and looking at the tech bubble. I think it's always interesting to take a look back, and you know, he was talking about Arista Networks. It's recently IPO'd, and it's still above its IPO price. But what were some recent tech IPOs that did well, and what were some recent ones that did not so well? So one good one was LinkedIn. It started the day in May 2011, started at 45, ended the day at 83, and now it's at 226. Pretty successful, I think. Priceline, that was way back in 99. That started at 18, went to 82.50, went all the way, dropped below $10 a share in 2001, but now it's at $1,277. So you can see that, and then you go back to there's a lot of examples of this. Amazon was at 18, went to 100, then dipped below $10 during the bust, and now it's at 331. eBay, it started at $18 a share in 98, went to 53, and you know it's pretty much kept on going. Twitter's a recent IPO in November 2013, started at 26, ended the day at 45, and today it's hanging at 37. So kind of ho-hum. But what you can see is that there are some tech IPOs that do well, some that definitely, and they can bust, you know, after everything, all the hype is out of them, they bust, but they can still be great investments long-term, and you can still, just because they busted doesn't mean they're bad companies. They just are getting back to normal valuations, and you can make a lot of money, like Amazon. But there are ones like Pets.com, which IPO'd at 11 and went bankrupt in, you know, November 2000. There's Zynga, which busted, eToys. So, you know, more IPOs eventually go out of business than survive, and you need to realize that. Now, before we close the hour, be sure to sign up to be an InvestTalk Insider. It's free, and it gives you access to our whole library of InvestTalk webinars. The latest one is ready now. It's called our Comprehensive Wealth Workshop on Retirement Preparation. I'm Portfolio Manager Justin Klein, and for Steve Peasley and everyone at KP Financial, we thank you for listening. Let's get back together again tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.